Okay, I want to pick up where we left off in the book of Chronicles. 1 Chronicles chapter 6 is where we left off. And for anybody that's new here, you came in the wrong night. That's all I can tell you. All right, we're going through a portion of the Bible where virtually nobody reads. And for good reason, too, because at least the first 9 chapters, there's over 500 different names. And these names are always very hard to pronounce. They're names of people or the names of places. But like I've said many, many times going through the Bible, I don't skip anything. I go through every book and every chapter and every verse and every word. Because Jesus Christ said that man doesn't live on bread alone, but every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. And, you know, even though this is a very, very neglected portion of Scripture, I still feel like, well, it's almost like digging in one of these mines, right? I mean, you got to really dig hard, and there's a lot of blood, sweat, and tears as you're digging. But there's a number of, I feel like precious gems to be gleaned from it. But it just takes a lot of effort and a lot of work. To try to draw out what God is trying to tell us in this. Now, this chapter 6, it's 81 verses. So all I can say is to sit down and shut up and hang on, man, because here we go. I mean, it's a tough one. But this chapter 6, I think the reason why it's so lengthy is because it's now going to be dealing with the tribe of Levi. And the tribe of Levi is the priestly tribe. That's why they put so much more emphasis upon this tribe in terms of its genealogy. And I believe, I can't be dogmatic about it, but I believe that it was Ezra who wrote 1st and 2nd Chronicles. And Ezra was a priest. And he was one of the ones that came back from the exile in Babylon. And even though they didn't have this, obviously, the sacrifices over there in Babylon, because the temple in Jerusalem had been destroyed and everything was in total ruins because of the judgment that God brought upon them, the people, for all their wickedness. Nevertheless, Ezra was a man who really, really sought God with all of his heart, and he was a scribe and he was a priest. And I think that he's the one that put all this together. Now, when we go through this priestly tribe, I think it's really, really important that we understand a few things of why God puts such an emphasis upon the priesthood and the people in the priesthood. But you know what's interesting to me is this. We haven't been through this in many years, but if you go back to Leviticus chapter 8 and chapter 9, there God sets forth a number of different commands and ordinances and statutes in regards to the priesthood as far as the priest being ordained. And I'll just give you a real thumbnail sketch about what it says in chapter 8 and chapter 9. But I don't know if you can see, like this diagram here of the tabernacle. Well, God told Aaron and his four sons, who were going to be designated as the priests who were able to offer sacrifices. Now, the tribe of Levi, all of them were to be priests, but they had all of them had different assignments, and we're going to be reading about that tonight. But it was only Aaron and his direct descendants who could offer sacrifice to the Lord, and who could go into that tabernacle. But what God did is that he had Aaron and his four sons stay in this court area, and they no doubt set up their own tents, and they may have even been staying inside that tabernacle itself. We're not told the details of it, but my point is this. God said during their ordination, they started off their ordination ceremony. It took 7 days, and they started with the sacrifice of a bull and a heifer and all these other things, including a ram for a sin offering and a ram for the ordination offering. And then they had to stay there for 7 days, and they could not go outside that court area under the penalty of death. Now, who can tell me why that was so important, that these people, that these priests had to stay in that court area for 7 days, to complete the ordination? What was God really trying to say to them?
Consecrate them? Direct influences, maybe?
What's it?
Maybe the influences are just contained, the outside world?
Very, very good, very good. Because what this boils down to is this. I think what God really wanted to emphasize here is, hey, if you guys are going to be priests for me, if you're going to be ministering to people on my behalf, then you got to spend quality prime time with me all alone. And this was their ordination. That's why they could not go outside that court area. They had to stay there day and night and commune with God. Now, this is what's so important that anybody, I don't care if you're in the ministry, what kind of ministry you're in. I don't care if you're a pastor, a priest, evangelist, a teacher, any kind of other type of ministry. We need to get along with God and spend prime time, quality time alone with God. Otherwise, we've got nothing to say in regards to representing God to man or man to God. That's why it's so important. Just go back to the Gospels and you see a situation with Mary and Martha. We all know that situation. But here Mary is. She's seated right at the feet of Jesus Christ. And she's having this one spirit connection with Jesus Christ in her spirit. And this is what we're told in Corinthians, that Paul makes this emphasis himself. He talks about the marriage covenant between a husband and wife, the one flesh union between a husband and wife, the sexual union between a husband and wife. And Paul says, if a man joins himself to a prostitute, he becomes one with her, one body with her. But he says, if you join yourself to the Lord, you become one spirit with him. So here Mary is sitting at Jesus' feet, and she's having this one spirit connection with him. And Jesus is sitting there in Martha, Mary, and Lazarus' house, and he's probably in the living room somewhere, surrounded by his disciples, and there Mary is having this connection with him, right? This one spirit union with him as Jesus Christ is explaining the Word of God to these people. And then who's getting all in a huff about this situation? Now, Martha, she loves Jesus. She knows Jesus, right? She cares for Jesus. And she is really in a huff, right? She's just really in a tizzy because she feels like there's so much pressure on her, you know, to set the table and to prepare the dinner and to get everything ready for the guests and everything. And she feels like her sister should be helping her. So, you can just see the devil just getting into her head. And now she just gets to the point where she's totally exasperated. She goes stomping into the room where Jesus is at, and she gives God a command. Jesus, tell my sister to help me with all of the preparations. And then what did Jesus Christ say to her?
Martha, Martha, you're chill.
Yeah, he said, Martha, Martha, you're all upset about nothing, man. He says, listen, only one thing is necessary, and Mary has chosen the better part, and she will not be denied of it, right? Now, here's the thing. Just put two and two together. Who do you think was more prepared to go out and minister to other people, to share the gospel, to share Jesus Christ, when they went outside that house? Would it be Martha or Mary? It's obvious, right? Because Mary has spent quality time, prime time, all alone with Christ in her spirit, right? That's what God is trying to emphasize here as far as this priesthood is concerned. And then when you go back to that ordination, they offered up a ram for a burnt offering and a ram for a dedication offering or ordination offering. Now, that's significant to me, too, because part of that ram, not the burnt offering, but the other one, they were to feed on, right? Now, what's the characteristic of a ram that, to me, would be so significant? Because keep this in mind. We are told in Galatians chapter 3 that all of this stuff in regards to the writings of Moses, the law, the dietary laws, the ceremonial laws, all of these different things of what you could touch, what you couldn't touch, all these cleansing laws, they all had their fulfillment in Christ, and Paul says that all these things were our teacher. So if they use a ram for ordination, what is God really trying to say here in regards to his priests? What's the characteristic of a ram?
Strength.
Yeah, strength, quickness, agility, speed. You know, we have some of these rams over in North America. They get up to be like 250 pounds, and their horns just get humongous. And during the rutting season, mating season, these rams will go at each other. And I mean, they will back up like 100 feet from each other, and then at full force, they'll come at each other and just collide. And that impact of that collision can be heard over 2 miles away. I mean, these rams are really going at it. Now, here's the thing, which is so significant to me about the ram, is the devil was very, very often portrayed with two horns. Now, what do horns symbolize in the Bible?
Power,
strength, authority, might. But if the devil has two horns, what kind of power and strength is it portrayed with him? It would be religious and political. Now, here's what I think is so significant about God's priests, is that they're always, always, always going to be buttoned up against who? The world, the flesh, the devil, all the opposition that's out there, right? And Jesus Christ, he was a type of a ram in the sense that how often do you read in the Gospels where he was saying to the people, woe unto you, woe unto you scribes, woe unto you Pharisees, woe to you hypocrites, and he would just pronounce one woe after another after another. He would be going toe-to-toe and head-to-head with the powers that be of his day, wasn't he? Mm-hmm. And so was John the Baptist, wasn't he? And I really strongly believe that that's what we need in the pulpit today more than ever before, is we need rams in the pulpits. But instead, we've got too many people in the pulpits today who are just mild-mannered preachers with giving mild-mannered sermons to mild-mannered congregations, and everybody goes home mild-mannered, but nobody's changed, nobody's fired up, nobody's motivated, nobody's convicted, nobody's challenged, right? That's why I think that the priesthood is so all-important here in what God is trying to say. Now, I'm going to say a couple other things before we really get into this, though, is that I think it's kind of significant that Jacob, when he was dying, this is what he said about Simeon and Levi, okay? Because you had Reuben, he was the firstborn, but he did not get the inheritance because he defiled his father's couch with one of his father's concubines, Bilhah. So the next in line would have been Simeon, and then the next Levi, and then the next would be Judah. But here's the thing. This is what Jacob said on his dying bed about these two sons. He said, Simeon and Levi are brothers. Their swords are implements of violence. Let not my soul enter into their council. Let not my glory be united with their assembly. Because in their anger they slew men, and in their self-will they lamed oxen. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will disperse them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. Now that was a profound prophecy about Simeon and Levi. And here's what's so significant about that. He said that these two guys were hotheads. And they had a real temper. All right, and they had a cruel streak in them. But here's what's so significant about this is that by the time Moses came on the scene, and then you had a situation where you've got Levi and you got Simeon. But remember when they had the situation with the golden calf, and then Moses came down and he's absolutely livid, he's absolutely just beside himself with anger, and he throws down the Ten Commandments, and then he says, who's with me? Because everybody's out of control, and perhaps even the Levites. But then when Moses came down, I think people kind of shaped up. All right, but then there was still a lot of people that were still out of control, and there was no getting them under control. So Moses said, who's with me? Then all the Levites came to Moses' side. He says, I want every one of you to get your sword, and you go through this camp here. Anybody that's out of control, you kill them. I don't care if it's your mother, your father, your brother, your sister, your best friend, you kill them. And that's what they did. And because they did that, God said that he was going to set them aside as the priest, because it was God's original intention that they were all to be, a kingdom of priests. Now, that's significant to me, because here's the Levites. They have a mean streak in them. They've got their hotheads, but now they channel their anger for the honor and glory of God. This is righteous anger. But then you take Simeon, who's the same kind of temperament that I was just reading about there in Genesis, and what happened to Simeon? Simeon was the one who was apparently, if you read it in Numbers, the leadership in the tribe of Simeon instigated people to become unfaithful to God at Baal of Peor. And as a matter of fact, when God was having the leaders executed, it says that there was a man there from the tribe of Simeon, and when all the people are out there weeping before the Lord, this guy takes in a Midianite woman into his tent, he starts getting it on with her, and when Phinehas sees this, the priest, he gets so angry, so livid, he's just beside himself, and he says, what's wrong with this guy? And he grabs a spear, goes into that tent, and throws it as hard as he can, and it goes right through the Simeonite, along with the woman he was getting it on with, Cosby, right? My point is this. Look at these two guys. God can use a man with a temper, I think, a lot more effectively than it can with a man, who doesn't get wrought up about anything. You understand what I'm talking about here? But you have to channel that. You see, now the Levites are the one that God selected, because here's the big difference between the Levites. I just read it there in Genesis about how Jacob said that he would scatter them in Israel. Interesting thing. Simeon, see Simeon down here? They got that southern portion of Israel. But guess what? After centuries, that whole tribe of Simeon got assimilated into Judah. became known as the southern tribe of Judah. They got assimilated into that. And then what happened to the Levites? They were scattered through Israel, right? Isn't that just what I read? I'm going to read it again because that's what he said in regards to the prophecy about them. He said this: cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, their wrath, for it is cruel. I will disperse them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. That's what happened. Simeon became assimilated into Judah, and then Levi was ended up being scattered all throughout. Now, I know that I've really taken a lot of time in prefacing this, and I'll try not to spend too much more time going through this, other than to mention a number of other things that might be highlighted here. But this is what it says in chapter 6 of 1 Chronicles. It says, the sons of Levi were Gershom, Kohath, and Merariah. And the sons of Kohath were Amram, Izhar, Hebron, and Uzziel. The children of Amram were Aaron, Moses, and Miriam. And the sons of Aaron were Nadab, Abihu, Eleazar, and Itamar. Now, it's going to give us the sons of Levi. All right, he had three sons. He had Gershom, he had Kohath, he had Merariah. Now, what's going to happen here is that God is going to divide these descendants of Levi. He's going to divide them into three different categories in terms of their function, because the Kohathites, Moses came from that particular line as far as the Levites were concerned, because it says here that verse 2, the sons of Kohath were Amram. Amram is Moses' father, and Izhar, and Hebron, and Uzziel, and the children of Amram were Aaron, Moses, and Miriam. My point is this: God gave different duties for this priesthood, all right? He told the Kohathites that their job, you know what their job was? Their job was to carry all the holy objects. They were to carry the Ark of the Covenant. They were to carry the golden altar of incense. They were to carry the golden lampstand. And they were to carry the golden table of showbread. All of these holy articles, that was their job. Transporting these very holy articles, and it was a very, very, very privileged job. And then you had the Gershonites. Their job, we see the tabernacle there? Their job was to take down all the curtains that went over the tabernacle, plus all the curtains that went around in that court. That was their job. Take down and put up the curtains, and to transport them. And the Merariathites, or the Merariites, they were the ones to take up the boards and the bars, the tent pillars and the sockets. That was their job, to set up all these sockets and these pillars and to transport them. Now, here's the thing. They all had a specific job to do, and it was a very privileged job, right? But then the Kohathites, they had a very, very select job. It was a very privileged job because they were the ones to carry the holy objects. But then Moses' cousin, Korah, remember what happened to him? Korah got really resentful. Korah, Dathan, and Abram, they became very resentful of Moses and Aaron, and they said, hey, all God's people are holy. Who told you guys you could be priests? We're all going to be priests. So he got 250 guys to offer incense to the Lord, and what happened was, because of that rebellion, God just split open the ground, and Korah, Dathan, and Abram, and all of their property and their animals and their families went down alive into the grave. And God just closed it back over because of their rebellion. Now, this is what can happen to people. Well, even when they have a very privileged job in a church, they can become envious or resentful or bitter because of somebody else's position, or somebody else gets more attention. And I would say this, that's a very dangerous place to go, because wherever God assigns us to in the church, he's given us specific jobs to do and specific talents to do the job. And one of the things that can really wreak havoc with the job that God assigns us to do is to envy somebody else's calling and want to be something that God's not calling us to be. All right, now I know that I kind of beat that to death too, but you got to look at what's being said here, because he also says in this verse 3, the children of Amram were Aaron, Moses, and Miriam. And the sons of Aaron were Nadab, Abihu, Eleazar, and Itamar. Now, anybody know what happened to Nadab and Abihu? Huh?
Strange fire before.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's exactly what they did, because in chapter 10 of Leviticus, this appears to be right after their ordination. It says that now Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron, took their respective fire pans and after putting fire in them, placed incense on it and offered strange fire before the Lord, which he had not commanded them. And fire came out from the presence of the Lord and consumed them, and they died before the Lord. And then it goes on to say this in that same chapter. I'm just putting this together. This is a little speculative on my part, but I think this is what happened, because it says here in this chapter 10 of Leviticus, it says, "Then the Lord spoke to Aaron, saying, 'Do not drink wine or strong drink, neither you nor your sons with you, when you come into the tent of meeting, so that you will not die. It is a perpetual statute throughout your generations, and so as to make a distinction between the holy and the profane, and between the unclean and the clean, and so as to teach the sons of Israel all the statutes which the Lord has spoken to them through Moses.'" Now, I get this impression. This is speculative, but I really believe what happened there, that after their 7 days and being set aside before God, then on the 8th day, they had that ordination ceremony, and apparently they had a big, huge celebration. And I think this Nadab and Abihu had a little too much to drink. All right, now here's the thing. I mean, God tells us in Psalm 104 that God has given wine to men to cheer men's hearts. But now, these guys had a little too much to drink. And it says they offered strange fire to the Lord. They put it in their censers. So, this is speculative too. But you know, in Leviticus chapter 2, God specifically said this. He said, "No grain offering which you bring to the Lord shall be made with leaven, for you shall not offer it up and smoke any leaven or any honey as an offering by fire to the Lord." Now, God told them specifically, all right, anything that goes on that altar there, I don't want any honey on it. Anything that goes into your censers, I don't want any honey in it. And I believe what happened is these guys probably thought, you know what, this would be a good idea. We'll put some honey in the censers and make it smell good or offer it up to God. And I believe that that's what happened there. Now, why would God say, "I don't want any honey on these sacrifices or anything that's offered in incense or as fire"?
Dying for man's sins is going to be a very bitter thing.
And not only that, honey is very, very palatable to man. It's what man likes, right? In other words, this is the thing. Paul tells us in Corinthians, man, he just jumped in their face and says, "Hey, man, don't you understand that I have married you or betrothed you to one husband, that is to Christ?" But he says, "Man, I'm afraid that just as the Satan deceived Eve," says, "some of you are being misled or led astray because now you've got a different Christ with a different spirit, a different gospel." And Paul tells the Galatians, he says, "Hey, man, if someone comes along and preaches a different gospel that other than the one that you have received from us, let that person be accursed. I don't care if it's an angel from heaven, let that angel be accursed," right? So, you know what's happening today all over this country, all over this world, but especially in our country in the pulpits today? Not every pulpit, but there are a lot of them, a growing number of them, is what happens now. Men like to have a different Christ with a different spirit and a different gospel where we do not deal with the sin issue. Instead, we want something that's palatable, something that tastes good, something that makes us feel good. That's strange fire unto the Lord. It is. And these guys, apparently, they had a little too much to drink. And what happens when you have a little too much to drink?
You do things you don't plan on doing.
Well, it affects the way you your judgment. It affects the way you react or the way you respond or the way you perceive things, right? And look what people do in the pulpit today. They get intoxicated with their positions, and what happens? They start putting strange fire before the Lord. And this is a stark warning, right? Mm-hmm. And now in verse 4 of chapter 6 of 1 Chronicles, it says, "Eleazar became the father of Phinehas, and Phinehas became the father of Abishua." Now, Phinehas, he was the one that in his righteous anger, he threw that spear right through Zimri and Cozbi. And because he did that, God checked the plague, and then God made a covenant with Phinehas. And he said that Phinehas was truly a man after his own heart. Now this guy, he exhibited righteous anger because he was jealous for God's namesake. He was angry because of what was happening. And you know what? I really do believe that we need a lot more ministers, pastors, and priests, and evangelists, that people that know how to get angry. And I don't mean you got to go to anger management because you can't control your anger. I mean we need to get angry about what's happening in our country, what's happening in the church, what's happening all over the place. Nobody's getting wrought up about these things, right? I'll give you an example, and it's not even has to deal with priests, but it does indirectly. But remember, I don't know how long it's been, 40, 50 years ago, Madeline Marie O'Hare, that God-hating woman, got God thrown out of our schools, right? You can't pray in school. You can't read the Bible in school. You can't mention God in school. You can't have anything that would remind you of God, right, in schools, right? So when this country decided, or this government decided, you know what, we're going to throw God out of our schools. Somehow they dug that out of the Constitution, which was all phony, because for hundreds of years we've had God in our schools and people are reading their Bible, right? But they decided, well, you know, I can't stomach the thought of God in our schools, so they threw him out. But you see what happened there? Well, there wasn't enough people in the pulpits, and there wasn't enough people in this country who could get wrought up and angry and say, no, you're not going to do that. To stand up and say, you're not going to do that. You're not throwing God out. We're throwing you out. We're impeaching you. You get out of here. You go get a real job. Instead, what did this country do? It just yawned, rolled over, passed gas, didn't do... It went back to sleep. See, that's our problem. We don't know how to get angry and when to get angry. See, it starts with all this apathy and indifference, and pretty soon it goes from apathy to indifference to then tolerating a lot of what's going wrong as far as the sins are concerned. And then when you get to the point where you tolerate it, then you embrace it. And when you embrace it, then you promote it. And then after you're promoting all these sins, then you vilify anyone who happens to disagree with it. This is the progression, right? That's because there's not enough people who know how to get angry, like Phinehas. Mm-hmm. He says in this verse 5 of 1 Chronicles chapter 6, he says, Abishu became the father of Buckai, and Buckai became the father of Uzai, and Uzai became the father of Zariah, and Zariah became the father of Marioth, and Marioth became the father of Amariah, and Amariah became the father of Ahitub, and Ahitub became the father of Zadok, and Zadok became the father of Amaziah, and Amaziah became the father of Azariah, and Azariah became the father of Johanan. And Johanan became the father of Azariah. It was he who served as a priest in the house which Solomon built in Jerusalem. And Azariah became the father of Amariah. And Amariah became the father of Ahitub. And Ahitub became the father of Zadok. And Zadok became the father of Shalom. And Shalom became the father of Hilkiah. And Hilkiah became the father of Azariah. And Azariah became the father of Sariah. And Sariah became the father of Jehozadak. And Jehozadak went along when the Lord carried Judah and Jerusalem away into exile by Nebuchadnezzar. Now, look at all these names. And a lot of these people, a lot of them have names of their forefathers, of their grandfathers, of their fathers. And so it just gets really confusing here. But I want to just point out one name here. Matter of fact, it's mentioned twice. It's in this verse 7. It says Ahitub became the father of Zadok, and Zadok became the father of Amaziah. But then if you jump down to this verse 12, it says Ahitub became the father of Zadok, and Zadok became the father of Shalom. Now, there's two different Zadoks here. Yeah. But I think that verse 8, that's Zadok, the priest. He was also a priest during David's reign. And you had two priests there. Abiathar the priest and Zadok the priest. And long story short, Abiathar, he came from the line of Eli. And because Eli did not discipline his sons, Hophni and Phinehas, God pronounced a curse on Eli's descendants, and he said that they would no longer be priests. And so the priesthood through the line of Eli basically ended with Abiathar. My point is this. You go back and you read that account there. It was Zadok who remained faithful to David during Absalom's revolt, and is also Adonijah's revolt. And Zadok remained faithful to David. He remained faithful to Solomon. And then because of this coup that Adonijah tried to pull off, and Abiathar the priest threw in his lot with Adonijah and Joab, and then Solomon just dismissed him as a priest. Said, pack up and get out of here. And so it was Zadok who remained faithful. But we just finished up the book of Ezekiel. And reading in the book of Ezekiel, reading the last 8 chapters, all right, 9 chapters, we do from 40 to 48, it dealt all with the millennial kingdom. Mm-hmm. But God is saying that it's the descendants of Zadok who are going to be the priests during Jesus Christ's reign. Mm-hmm. You guys remember that? Mm-hmm. Because of his faithfulness. Mm-hmm. All right. So this guy, because of his faithfulness for hundreds of generations down the line, or I don't know hundreds, but generation after generation after generation, it comes down even during the millennial period, this Zadok's descendants are going to be acting as priests during Christ's reign.
John, is that the Zadok in verse 12? That Zadok?
It's verse 8, I believe. That's verse the Zadok. Yeah, because look at that verse 8. It says, Ahitub became the father of Zadok, and Zadok became the father of Amaziah, and Amaziah became the father of Azariah, Azariah became the father of Johanna, and Johanna became the father of Azariah. It was he who served as priest in the house of Solomon. Mm-hmm. See, so it would be the Zadok in verse 8 rather than the Zadok in verse 12.
Okay?
That's what I get out of it. Mm-hmm. And now what's going to happen here is we're going to be reading these names all over again because they're enumerated, you know, here, there, and everywhere. But just looking at it, you got to ask yourself, well, why is there so much emphasis put upon this priesthood? I think it's pretty plain that God puts a tremendous premium on his priest. Now, here's the thing, too. Simply because a person is called into the priesthood or called into the ministry, called, I don't care what denomination, man, that doesn't guarantee you you're going to make it to heaven. It just flat out does not. I've said this many, many times over the years. I'd rather stand before God as a gross, flagrant, unrepentant sinner and stand before God as some kind of pastor, minister, or priest, or evangelist, or teacher that misled people. The last thing I want to hear from God is, hey, man, you just misled all these people, and now they're in hell because of you. Man, that's the last thing I want to hear. But now, you can see it. You can see it time and time again and again, that there's some pretty bad priests that you read all about in the Bible. And now look at the 12 apostles. Where's Judas tonight? Where's Judas? You know, it was Jesus Christ who said of Judas, it would be better if that man were never born. Now, Judas is not where he's supposed to be. But look at the high place of privilege. That's why James says, don't all of you become teachers, brethren. Why? What's that? Yeah, because you're going to incur just that much more of a stricter judgment. And so in that verse 15, it says, Jehozadak went along when the Lord carried Judah and Jerusalem away into exile by Nebuchadnezzar. See, they followed his priestly line even when they got thrown out of their land. They kept a pretty strict record as far as the priests are concerned. Now, undoubtedly, even reading these names, even though there's a lot of them, undoubtedly there were some names that are probably missing. But you can see that when they do the genealogy. Sometimes they just block it. Certain number, like in Matthew, they got 14 generations, 14 generations, 14 generations, right? And some names are omitted and some names are added. You know, but all I'm saying is this. The importance that God is putting upon this line, because these are the people who are supposed to represent God to man and man to God. And he says here in that verse... Yeah.
Sorry. In the past, you've mentioned Hilkiah as the one who found the laws from Moses in the wall?
Well, yeah. I don't know if this is the same one.
Oh.
I'm not sure. It very well could be. All right. Looking at this time frame here, it very well could have been.
And he decided to turn.
Right, right. And he very well could have been the one that we read about that in Kings, to point out that they found a scroll in the temple, and it was in regards to God's wrath that was going to come upon his people because of all their wickedness. And it was Josiah that basically got things turned around. All right, that very well could have been the Hilkiah that was talked about there. So good, that's a good insight there. I didn't even put that one together. But in verse 16, it says, the sons of Levi were Gershom, Kohath, and Merariah. Now see what I'm saying? It's reiterating this. And then it says in verse 17, these are the names of the sons of Gershom. Now Gershom, if you remember, I just mentioned, what was his job?
Well, with the curtain.
Yes, he had the job of taking down all the curtain coverings off the tabernacle, plus the curtains that went around in that court area. He had needed to take them down and transport them. That was his job. So he's talking about here, the sons of Gershom, Libni, and Shimei. The sons of Kohath were Amram, Ishar, Hebron, and Uzziel. And like I said, Kohath, his descendants had the job of transporting the most holy things. And then it says in verse 19, the sons of Merariah were Mahli and Mushi, and these are the families of the Levites according to their households. And like I said, the Merarites, they had the job of, you know, taking the boards and the bars and the tent pillars and the sockets and the pillars. That was their job. Now, just look at this tabernacle here. Can you see it? You got all of these pillars here. You got all these sockets here that these things are placed in. What if one of the priests said, and let's say it was his job to take these pillars and these sockets and put them on a cart and haul it off. What if he said to himself, oh, you know what? I got such a flunky job here. I mean, any Tom, Dick, or Harry could do it. I'm not going to do that. To heck with it. Leave it there. Now, everybody does their job except this clown, right? And then when they go to set it up, they're missing some very important parts of this tabernacle. And I would say this, man, it's so important that we realize that we all have a job to do. Every one of us, and if every one of us, and we might feel like, well, my job is so totally insignificant. What's the point to it? You know, any fool can do this job. No, what we need to do is have an attitude. Okay, whatever God tells me to do, I don't care if it's cleaning toilet bowls. I need to do the best job I possibly can do for the honor and glory of God. And I can guarantee you, when we have that kind of attitude, it won't be very long before we'll be doing bigger and better things, you know. That's all there is to it, right? And he says here in that verse of 20, of Gershom, Libni his son, and Jahath his son, and Zimrah his son, and Joah his son, and Iddo his son, and Zerah his son, and Jethiel his son, and the sons of Kohath were Abimadad his son, and Korah his son, and Asher his son, and Elkanah his son, and Ebiasaph and his son, and Asher and his son, and Tahath and his son, Uriel his son, Uzziah his son, and Shaul his son. The sons of Elkanah were Amasai and Ahimoth. For Elkanah, the sons of Elkanah were Zophai his son, and Nahath his son, and Eliab his son, and Joham his son, and Elkanah his son. The sons of Samuel were Joel the firstborn, and Abijah the second. Now, here's an interesting thing about Samuel. And this is something I'm sure the critics could probably have one of their field days. Is Samuel here is listed in the priesthood. But where is Samuel from? Do you remember? Because it says this in 1 Samuel. About, remember Hannah? All right, it just says this. Now there was a certain man from Ramoth Zophim from the hill country of Ephraim, and his name was Elkanah, the son of Jeroham, the son of Eliu, the son of Tohu, the son of Zoph, an Ephraimite. And he had two wives, and the name was one was Hannah, and the other one was Peniel. And my point is this. He ended up, Elkanah had a son, and they named him Samuel. Mm-hmm. And people say, well, Samuel acts as a priest, but it says here he's from the hill country of Ephraim. But I don't think people are reading that right, because what all that is saying is that Elkanah was a Levite who lived in Ephraim. Mm-hmm. It's like saying, well, this person's a New Yorker, or that person's a Sacramentan. Well, it doesn't tell you anything about their family. It's just you know, where they come from, because the Levites were scattered all throughout Israel. So that's all that's saying there, all right? Because Samuel, in my opinion, yes, he was from the tribe of Levi. Even though it says that his father was an Ephraimite, it only means that they were living in Ephraim, because they were scattered all through Israel. They didn't have a tribe of Levi in terms of territory. And so he says in that verse 28, the sons of Samuel were Joel his firstborn, Abijah the second. And don't forget about, what did it say about Samuel's sons? Anybody remember? Samuel was a very, very, very godly man, with a man of integrity, and he really served the Lord with all his heart. But then the people got dissatisfied with Samuel's sons, because they were acting as judges, but they were corrupt. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and that's why they wanted a king. They were demanding a king. So here you got a situation again. God doesn't have any grandchildren. If your father's Billy Graham, that doesn't mean that you're going to get to heaven on his coattails, right? Everybody has got to accept Jesus Christ and commit to themselves, all right? I don't care if your parents are, I don't care if your father's a pastor. I don't care if your mother sings in a choir. That's not going to get us to heaven. Every person has to make a decision themselves. Then it says in this verse 29 of 1 Chronicles, chapter 6, it says the sons of Meriah were Malai and Libni and his son, and Shimei his son, and Uzza his son, Shimea his son, Hag Gai his son, Asaiah his son. Now these are those whom David appointed over the service of the songs of the house of the Lord. After the ark rested there, they ministered with song before the tabernacle of the tent of meeting until Solomon had built the house of the Lord in Jerusalem, and they served in their office according to their order. These are those who served with their sons. From the sons of the Kohathites were Heman the singer, the son of Joel, the son of Samuel, the son of Elkiah, the son of Jeroham, and the son of Eliel, the son of Toa, the son of Zoph, the son of Elkanah, the son of Mahath, the son of Amasai, the son of Elkanah, the son of Joel, the son of Azariah, the son of Zephaniah, the son of Tahath, the son of Aser, the son of Ebisaph, the son of Korah, the son of Izhar, the son of Kohath, the son of Levi, the son of Israel. Heman's brother Asaph stood at the right hand, even Asaph, the son of Berechiah, the son of Shimeah, the son of Michael, the son of Baaseiah, and the son of Malchijah, the son of Ethni, the son of Zerah, the son of Adaiah, the son of Ethan, the son of Zimma, the son of Shimei, the son of Jahath, the son of Gershom, the son of Levi. On the left were their kinsmen, the sons of Meraiah, the Ethan, the son of Kishai, the son of Abdi, the son of Maloch, the son of Habishai, the son of Amaziah, the son of Hilkiah, the son of Amzai, the son of Bani, the son of Shemir, the son of Mehai, the son of Mushai, the son of Meraiah, the son of Levi. Their kinsmen, the Levites, were appointed for all the services of the tabernacle of the house of God. Now, I just want to say this in passing in regards to this priesthood here, because when David came along, he assigned different Levites to be singers. And he was talking about this Asaph here. Like, for example, in that verse 39, Heman, the brother of Asaph, stood at his right hand. Asaph, the son of Berechiah. Well, Asaph, if you read from Psalm 73 to 83, mm-hmm. I'll just give you an example where it says in Psalm 73, it says, the end of wickedness contrasted that with the righteousness, a psalm of Asaph. And you will find that Psalm 73, 74, 75, 76, 70, all the way up to 83, is saying a psalm of Asaph. Mm-hmm. So I believe it was during David's day that he composed a number of the psalms, and he was a choir leader, right, as a priest. And I think that God puts a lot of emphasis upon that because, you know, there's an old saying, he who sings is free. In other words, in singing to God, you're actually praising God, right? And if we praise God, I think that even in some of the most difficult times, it will enable us to rise above our circumstances as long as we're praising God. But if we're going to be like the people of the Old Testament where they were always murmuring and griping and complaining and kicking Moses in the shins like snot-nosed kids that are being dragged along the way through the desert, that just angers God. He got angry to the point when they were complaining and murmuring and griping and carrying on and on and on. He just, judged them by sending fiery serpents all through the camp. And when he did that, and people were being bit and they were dying, how did they get healed of being bit?
They looked up at that serpent on a pole.
God said, what I want you to do is to make a bronze pole and put a bronze serpent on it. Now, when they went through the camp with this bronze pole, people were said, look at this bronze pole and you'll be healed. And I'm sure there was a number of people in the camp who were in their tents dying, and they said, hey, come on, look at this bronze pole, you'll be healed. And they say, oh, I don't need that, I need some medicine, man. And then they died, right? Well, who made reference to this bronze pole in John chapter 3, the Gospel of John?
Are you saying when Jesus said he'll be lifted up?
Good. That when the famous quote, John 3:16, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that those who believe in him should not perish but have everlasting life. And Jesus, right there in that same context, says, just as the bronze serpent, Moses lifted up the bronze serpent in the desert, so shall the Son of Man be lifted up, and he will draw all men to himself. That Jesus Christ was going to become sin for man and take the penalty of man's sin, mm-hmm. right, upon himself. You know what? Do you remember what verse I left off here?
Yeah.
What verse?
You went all the way to...
right here to 48.
48, okay. All right, and 48 says, their kinsmen, the Levites, were appointed for all the service of the tabernacle of the house of God. But Aaron and his sons offered on the altar burnt offerings and on the altar of incense for all the work at the most holy place and to make atonement for Israel according to all that Moses, the servant of God, had commanded. And all he's saying there, remember, I was talking about how he broke up the priesthood into three different categories, but there was actually the fourth category were the priests themselves who could go into the tabernacle and change out the showbread and light the incense that was before the veil, and also to change out the wick as far as the light was concerned, and the high priest could go into the Holy of Holies once a year. It was Aaron and his direct descendants, the only ones could act as priests in that function, offering up sacrifices, right? That was the function of those priests. And like I said, people became envious of them. Moses' own cousin Korah became very, very resentful of that, and then he met a terrible end. So these priests, I mean, God holds them to a much higher standard. And you got these two guys, Nadab and Abihu. It appears that right after their ordination, God slays them. You know, there's an old saying that says, familiarity can breed contempt. And familiarity, it can breed contempt right at the very altar of God. Mm-hmm. If we become too familiar with something, it can breed contempt. And in verse 50, he says, these are the sons of Aaron: Eleazar his son, Phinehas his son, Abishio his son, Bukkai his son, Uzai his son, Zeriah his son, Merioth his son, Amariah his son, Ahitub his son, Zadok his son, Amaziah his son. Now, just that 53, look at how many times they're repeating these guys' names. Right? Ezra, I think, really wanted to emphasize, okay, who the priests were, all the way down to their genealogies, right? Mm-hmm. Now, nobody knows today, as far as Israel is concerned, what tribes they belong to. Maybe some of them do, but I'm sure that most of them don't, right? God knows, and God, when he comes back, there's going to be the Levitical priesthood that's going to be reinstituted, and Zadok's descendants are going to be the ones who are going to be offering sacrifices to God. Now, what we're going to do here, we're just going to wind this down. Now he's going to be talking about the different borders that they get as far as their land, but keep this in mind. When they originally got into the land, God gave them 48 different cities for the priests to be in, and they could have the pasture land around each city. But as obviously the population of Israel began to grow, then they would build more cities. So priests would go to the new cities, right? Mm-hmm. And God actually sanctioned 6 different cities originally to be what he referred to as the cities of refuge, mm-hmm. right? He had 3 on one side of the Jordan, 3 on the other side. In other words, on the east side of the Jordan, he had Golan, and he also had Ramoth Gilead, and he also had Bezer. And on the west side of the Jordan, he had Kadesh, he also had Shechem, and he also had Hebron. Now, if you look at the way God staggered those cities, they were the cities of refuge. Those cities, God said this: if a person accidentally killed somebody else, accidentally, it was involuntary manslaughter. If you were out there chopping wood with your buddy and your axe head went flying off the axe handle and the axe head went right into the skull of your buddy and you killed him, total accident, right? But God said, listen, if it's a total accident, then what you need to do is just drop everything and run to one of these cities of refuge. And then people need to investigate, was this truly an accident or was this premeditated murder? And God said this: if it was truly an accident, then he could stay in that city of refuge. And he had to stay in that city of refuge because otherwise, God said, the blood avenger, who would be the closest kin to the one who was killed, had an obligation before God to slay the person who accidentally killed somebody, right? Mm-hmm. Now, how long did he have to stay in the city of refuge? Anybody remember?
Until the priest died.
What priest?
The high priest.
Now, that pointed Jesus Christ, right? In other words, he's our high priest, right? And when he died, now we're free. But here's the thing. Jesus Christ is our city of refuge. But let's just say a guy accidentally did that and then went to one of these cities of refuge and he's there for 6 months, a year, 6 years, 10 years. He says, man, this old coot is never going to die. I'm never going to get out of here. And then he decides, oh, I'm going to sneak out of here and go see my family, go see my girlfriend. Well, if he got outside that city, the blood avenger, the closest kin, if he saw him, he had a moral obligation to take his life. Now, what does that tell us spiritually? It says this: we have to remain in the city of refuge. We have to remain in Christ. If we decide, now I'm going to get out, go back to the world, now the blood avenger would represent who spiritually or what spiritually? The blood avenger represents the law. And if we are outside of Christ and we die under the law, where do we go? Go to hell. We have to be in the city of refuge. I just wanted to preface that when we're winding this down here, because it says in verse 54, now these are the settlements according to their camps with their borders, to the sons of Aaron of the families of the Kohathites, for theirs was the first lot. To them he gave Hebron in the land of Judah, in its pasture lands around it, but the fields of the city and its villages they gave to Caleb, the son of Jephunneh. So right in here is where the Kohathites got their cities, right in around in the Hebron area. And remember Caleb, he was the one that wanted that territory right there in Hebron. But that was full of giants, remember? But Caleb, 85 years old, he says, "Give me this mountain, man." You know, what 85 year old says that? They say, "Man, where's the other place I go lay down and take a nap?" Now, this guy, you know, God just preserved him because of his faithfulness, right? And in verse 57, it says, "And to the sons of Aaron, they gave the following cities of refuge: Hebron and Libnah, also with his pasture lands, Jeter and Ishtimo, with his pasture lands and on Highland with its pasture lands, and Debrin with its pasture lands, Ashan with its pasture lands, Beth Shemeth with its pasture lands, and from the tribe of Benjamin, Geba with its pasture lands, and Alemeth in its pasture lands, and Anoth in its pasture lands, and all their cities throughout their families were 13 cities. Then to the rest of the sons of Kohath were given by lot from the families of the tribe, from the half tribe of Manasseh 10 cities, to the sons of Gershom according to their families were given from the tribe of Issachar, and from the tribe of Asher, and from the tribe of Naphtali, and the tribe of Manasseh, 13 cities in Bashan. To the sons of Merariah, they were given by lot according to their families, from the tribe of Reuben, the tribe of Gad, and the tribe of Zebulun, 12 cities. So the sons of Israel gave to the Levites the cities with their pasture lands, and they gave by lot from the tribe of the sons of Judah, the tribes of the sons of Simeon, and the tribes of the sons of Benjamin, these cities which are mentioned by name. Now some of the families of the sons of Kohath had cities of their territory from the tribe of Ephraim, and they gave them the following cities of refuge: Shechem in the hill country of Ephraim with its pasture lands, Gezer also with its pasture lands, Jokmeam with its pasture lands, and Beth Horon with its pasture lands, Ajalon with its pasture lands, and Gath Rimmon with its pasture lands, and from the half a tribe of Manasseh, Aner and his pasture lands, and Baal-Aim with his pasture lands, for the rest of the family, the sons of Kohath. The sons of Gershom were given from the family of the half-tribe of Manasseh, Golan in Bashan with his pasture lands, and Ashtaroth with his pasture lands, and from the tribe of Issachar, Kadesh with his pasture lands, Debirath with his pasture lands, and Ramoth with his pasture lands, and Anim with his pasture lands, and from the tribe of Asher, Meshal with his pasture lands, and Abdon with his pasture lands, Ukoth with its pasture lands, and Rehob with its pasture lands, and from the tribe of Naphtali, Kadesh in Galilee with its pasture lands, and Hammon with its pasture lands, and Kirath Aim with its pasture lands. To the rest of the Levites, the sons of Merari were given from the tribe of Zebulun, Ribmono with its pasture lands, Tabor with its pasture lands, and beyond the Jordan at Jericho, the east side of the Jordan, were given them from the tribe of Reuben, Bezer in the wilderness with its pasture lands, and Jaza with its pasture lands, Kedemoth with its pasture lands, and Mepheth with its pasture lands, and from the tribe of Gad, Ramoth in Gilead with its pasture lands, and Mahanaim in its pasture lands, Heshbon with its pasture lands, and Jazer with its pasture lands. Now, just in closing this, get this picture here. All right, they've got all these cities on both sides of this Jordan, all right? And they're giving and they're assigning all of these different priests with the, you know, with their different responsibilities, different cities. And they get pasture lands around the city because people, they would pay the priests by giving them, you know, livestock and other things. And they could own their livestock. So they were allotted that pasture land, but they were never given any territory. Now, here's the thing. Just keep this in mind. Even though this reading can be very, very monotonous and most people will never bother to read it, God's gone to great lengths to try to emphasize the fact that he's given all these different cities and all these different territories within these different tribes to the priestly tribe. Now, what is God's real intention here, or one of his primary intentions of putting priests in cities? Expound upon that.
Isn't it centrally located? More people can come to him?
Well, put it this way. Maybe I'm not asking this question right. But we're all sinners, right? No, there's no doubt about it. I mean, I don't know of any exceptions, right? Maybe you, but... But here's the thing. We're all... Okay, so what happens when you have a real concentration of sinners in a particular place? What's that? Well, there it is. Where you have a concentration of sinners, you're going to have a concentration of sin. Just look at our cities. what characterizes our cities today? Crime, drugs, prostitution, immorality, all kinds of wickedness, right? I mean, this characterizes our city. You go out to the farmlands, I mean, you don't have that problem, right? So what's God's intention here when he's putting the priests in the cities? Because when you have a concentration of sinners, you got a concentration of sin. So God wants to concentrate his priests in these cities because he wants them to be the salt of the earth, the leaven for society, the light of the world. He wants them to arrest corruption that is bound to proliferate in a city. You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. You see God's reasoning here? Mm-hmm. That's why God has gone through all this trouble, giving us all this detail, right? Mm-hmm. Now, does anybody have anyone to share?